You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
That music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a beautiful day, but yesterday was so rainy. I haven't seen that much rain come down in months.
Years, actually, all at once. And neither has apparently the National Weather Service, because it was not on the weather prediction for us to have that kind of rainstorm in Davis yesterday, nor was it really noted in most of the weather stations that are official weather stations. But there were some localized downpours that were phenomenal. So back up here. Lois and I are preparing the show on May 27, 2026, for broadcast on May 28, 2026. I'm going to start with a catered alert. This is sent out by the station. If you can't find your favorite KDRT shows in our online archives right now, parenthetically, I would note, or haven't found the podcast in some cases, please know that we all are working hard to get things up and running again at kdrt.org. You can always listen live 95.7 FM if you're within the broadcast range, which is basically the city of Davis. You can listen to the live stream just about anywhere. Just visit kdrt.org. You'll see the live stream bar at the top of the homepage. You can catch many archive shows on podcast apps, but now I'm moving off of the catered alert. We learned a few days ago that the RSS feeds, which cause the podcasts to occur, are not functioning at the moment as we prepare this for broadcast. Consultants will be coming in today, the 27th, 28th, figure out what's going on. Hopefully it'll be a very simple thing to correct. But we are aware that many of you who get the podcast through that RSS feed, well, you won't hear this for about another week. So I'm speaking in the future about what happened in the past and trying to explain it to you. So if you happen to get the show through the station RSS feed, your podcast will be delayed by a few days, and then they'll all show up again. They'll all download to your computer. But if you're ever, as I know some of you listen at a particular time, like Saturday morning or something, if you're not finding it or it's not there on your computer already, you can always go to davisgardenshow.com, and I upload it there and I make a link, and there's at least an archive there that you can listen to through your computer, or if you're really tech savvy, through your phone. I'm sure some of you have figured out how to do this. Hopefully this will all be corrected shortly. It's because, getting back to the weather, about a week plus ago, we had a windstorm here that was phenomenal. A north wind that took out power in the region. Power on my farm was out for 30 hours, which I can tell you is just long enough to spoil all the food in your refrigerator and your freezer. And then it was out in many parts of Davis, and it did take the station off the air. It did a lot of wind damage around the area. Branches came down, trees came down, and the station had to reboot. And in the process of rebooting, we did run into some of these technical issues. We then flipped right around, cooled off very nicely. Weather up until day before yesterday, and yesterday was mild, pleasant, clouds in the sky, lots of sunshine, temperatures in the 70s, basically breaking 80 degrees, just barely mid-50s at night. And then yesterday, when we were supposed to have more of that, a line of squall clouds, I don't even know what else to call them, storm clouds, storm cells, stretching from the Coast Range over to the foothills, came right down the valley from the northwest. And there were isolated storm cells over Marysville, Woodland, Davis, apparently parts of the foothills. It didn't hit Dixon particularly anywhere near as much as it did those areas. We're standing in Davis and suddenly heard thunder continuously for 5 or 10 minutes right up over what apparently was right over Woodland, where they were getting a downpour. A few minutes later, that hit Davis. I have actually never seen in 45 years. So much water flowing for a brief period down Fifth Street as we had yesterday. The sidewalk was completely flooded. Water was flowing down very rapidly and dramatically. And people were reporting the same kind of thing around town. Various intersections got flooded. There was hail for a brief period. And we did get a lot of thunder and lightning. Someone sent me a question. Do you have any idea how much rain we got? Generally speaking, the weather stations themselves, well, the Davis weather station is out west of campus, didn't pick up much of anything, so it didn't really show much. But if you go to Weather Underground, one of the things I've liked about that particular private weather source for years is that they have a whole bunch of private weather stations, I assume that's what they are, at the bottom of every page for every site, of automated weather stations that would appear to be in people's backyards. And so the question was, how much rain did we get in that 1 or 2 hour period when it was really, really pouring here? In a 6 hour period, it showed a station in Willowbank, which is in
that's where I am.
Yeah, not far from where you are, not far from where this listener that reported over an inch of rain in a 1 hour period, with most of that falling in about a 10 minute period. We got a quarter to a half inch of rain for sure in just a few minutes. And the point being, with that kind of water coming down and the infiltration rate of our soil here being what it is, and of course many hard surfaces like asphalt, it simply began to run off. We got significant runoff and brief periods of flooding. They reported water running down the side of their yard, I guess coming into the garage. We watched it flowing down the street and people driving just casually through it like there was no problem. It was quite a large amount of rainfall coming down in a very brief period. And then as I was driving home, less than an hour later, sun was coming out, sparkling clear, and no sign of anything further. So it was several major storm cells that hit various areas in the valley, but didn't necessarily hit the official weather station in your area. As much as an inch of rain in less than an hour was very, very dramatic. We're not going to go into the weather forecast, because by the time some of you hear this, it'll be weather, what was the term you used?
Aftercast.
But,
no, well, it's fore and aft, you know.
Yeah, there you go.
Aftcast.
So the forecast, the aftcast, the real question we always want to tie in with is, what impact will this kind of thing have in your garden? And when we go from 92, 93 degrees one day, 8 or 9 days ago, to a high in the 60s yesterday, and I think it hit 70, and the low this morning, 48 degrees, that's a pretty dramatic swing with a whole lot of soil moisture added. The one adverse impact I can think of that is the possibility it would increase the likelihood of blossom end rot on tomatoes, because that low temperature, 48 degrees, is lower than than tomatoes would prefer to have, or any of your summer vegetables. It's a very brief period, but combined with saturated soil, any fruit that's in the expansion phase might get blossom end rot. That seems to be the strongest correlation, is soil temperature, these kind of wild fluctuations, and excess soil moisture. So first of all, you don't need to be watering right now in most areas around Davis. Even if you didn't get that full inch of rain in 1 hour, you probably got enough, and it's cool enough that you don't need to be concerned about it. And we might see some blossom end rot, but that would only be on fruit that is already going into the expansion phase. Other than that, the other concern I have, gentleman walked in with a leaf and said, "Can you tell me what's wrong with my Lavatera?" I know, it always sounds like I'm digressing terribly when I do these things. Okay. Leaf of Lavatera, which is a mallow shrub, right? Lavatera bicolor, which is a beautiful, big, sort of soft-wooded shrub that has little flowers that look like lilac-colored hibiscus. It was covered with black and orange pustules. I mean, just bumpy with them. It was really gross, actually. Unfortunately, he put it in a plastic bag. If you're taking a pest problem to a garden center, or to the folks at the master gardeners at the Central Park Farmers Market or anywhere, please always put your pest in a plastic bag. And that was rust.
And you don't need it escaping in the nursery.
No, we don't want it escaping. And in the case of a fungus, in this case, it might escape because the black spores of rust are ready to burst and splash to nearby plants. So we'll talk briefly about rust. It is a fungus. It has heavy spores. The one that he has on his Lavatera is specific to Malvaceae, which is the mallow family. Lavatera is in the mallow family. Another well-known member of the mallow family that you might have in your garden is hollyhock. And they do get rust really badly. Many other plants get rust, snapdragons, roses, turf,
But
bluegrass.
it's different rust.
In each case, yes. So the one that goes on Lavatera, I assume will probably go to Hollyhock because I believe it is host specific within the mallow family, but doesn't go out of the mallow family. Your Snapdragon 6 feet away, it gets its own special rust, not the rust that comes from the Hollyhock. The other thing about rust is that, so they're very host specific, and certain plants get them. And when the spores are orange, they're very visible. They're the color of Cheetos. You can take your thumb on the underside of the leaf and rub it. It comes off on your thumb. Those are not yet mature spores, but it's one of the simplest diagnostic. And the top of the leaf will often be a little bumpy and very commonly yellow right where the rust spore is on the other side of the leaf. So you'll have yellow spots on the top, orange spores on the bottom, come off on your thumb. Really recognizable problem. They're getting to the stage now on your Lavatera, your hollyhock, your snapdragon, your turf, your roses, where they're turning black. And that means they're getting ready to burst. And when they burst, they usually just sort of fall to the ground. But if we have sprinklers spraying onto the plant or hard rainfall, they'll splash down to the ground and back up, or from one leaf to another. And that is how many disease problems spread. Right now, I think this is going to be the major one. Rust spores are right ready to spread, and the rain spread them everywhere. I only thing I could tell him, people come in with a fungus disease, they're looking for a fungicide. There aren't any curative fungicides really readily available to home gardeners anymore. Nothing ever really worked very well on rust diseases in the first place, even when we had more effective fungicides. And at this stage of the life cycle of the fungus, it's just not going to do anything at all. The rust spore itself is pretty impervious to any pesticide or fungicide, I should say, that you would even be thinking of. So you cut it back really hard. And he said, "What do you mean?" I said, "You cut your Lavatera to the ground and you take every part of the plant away. And then you let it regrow and you monitor the leaves as it regrows. If you first see some spores on a plant, you can pick those leaves off and actually get pretty good control that way. People have been doing that for years with things like snapdragons and hollyhocks. You put it in, you see a few spores show up, you pick those leaves off, you put them in a bag, you throw them away, and you can actually remove them all and you can get past the problem. But if you don't, if you just cut the plant back and leave spores on the lower leaves, they'll just splash right back up onto the new growth as it grows, or next winter as the rains come back. So it's important to remove as much of the material as you possibly can. The good news is I've cut back Lavatera very hard. You can do it any time of year, as far as I can tell, and you don't hurt it, and it resprouts very vigorously. That goes for many of the soft-wooded mallows. So Lavatera is one, Anisodontia. Though is another one that can sometimes get this disease. The problem will be things like your hollyhocks because they get the rust as they're coming into bloom. So go ahead, let them bloom out, throw out the seed because the rust spores get on the seed. And that's how it carries from generation to generation on hollyhocks and snapdragons. So get rid of all that seed when they're done blooming, pull them out, get rid of all your hollyhocks for a couple of months. Buy or start nice new healthy hollyhock seedlings. Check them very carefully for rust. Yeah, this goes for snapdragons too, by the way. And then plant them out and you're back in business. But you've got to get rid of every bit of what's there. And that's challenging to do with hollyhocks because you'll notice, hey, there's a seedling over there and a seedling over there. And we have mallows that are weeds in this area. Common cheeseweed, Malva, it very commonly gets this rust disease and I assume shares it with hollyhocks and Lavatera. So if you happen to have common mallow on your property, pull all that out. In other words, get rid of everything that's related that might have this disease, put it all in a bag, send it away, wait till fall, go ahead and plant new ones. I can tell you, as someone who has tried to grow hollyhocks and snapdragons to sell, rust on the seedlings is a common problem for us. We buy the seed from legitimate seed sources, we plant it. I now very carefully check the seedling trays as they're growing, and it's not uncommon on some of the first true leaves to have rust already beginning to infect the plant. It is really up to nursery owners and managers to correct this problem. Picking off a couple leaves without inspecting carefully, you're just disseminating rust to your customers if you don't monitor very carefully. So you've got to monitor them and know there's not a spray that you can use that's really going to work in your situation either. So you've got to sell clean plants to the public. If you're the public buying them, you need to check them to make sure they're clean. Snapdragons in particular, it's not uncommon at all for me to be walking through one of the big places that sells flowers to the public and walk over to the snapdragons and pick up the six pack, flip it over to look at the underside of the leaf and already see rust spores on the plants that people are buying. So you got to check the plants. It'd be great if nurseries were better about it. Get rid of every bit of the rust. And this is unfortunately the kind of weather that causes it to spread. On the plus side, it's great weed pulling weather right now. The plants got a nice watering. Your vegetables will almost surely be fine despite the slightly lower temperatures over the last couple of evenings. And of course, we're going into a warming trend. So we should be back in the low 90s within 7 to 10 days, depending on when you're listening to the broadcast.
Okay, so I have an announcement. It's going to be June 11th. Our show should be out to people by then.
So yes, we hope so.
We hope so. So this is the Master Gardeners program of Yolo County, and they have these Zoom presentations every 2 weeks, this time, June 11th from 3 to 4 p.m. on Zoom, and it's how to fix irrigation leaks to save water. Yeah. I will give you the contact. And this is Joan Tuss, who has made her email available in public for anybody who wants to get more information or sign up or whatever. Yeah. So joan.tuss@yolocounty.gov. So that's joan.tuss@yolocounty.gov.
Yeah, the Arboretum Walks with Warren continue. The next one coming up is... says Don, not prepared for this. Here we go. Upcoming events. Walk with Warren. Immerse yourself in the vivid beauty of the UC Davis Arboretum as you embark on a midday adventure through gardens and collections with your guide, Warren Roberts, Superintendent Emeritus and Superior Punster. June 17th, 2026, 12 to 1 p.m. at the Shields Gazebo on the west end of the Arboretum. Walk with Warren, June 17th, once a month, June 17th, 2026, noon to 1.
Ricker, we have an announcement, an alert, a warning. Don, tell me about this glassy-winged sharpshooter.
Okay, this is actually a big deal. Every ag commissioner in Northern California is sending this alert out. I got mine by email from the Yolo County Agricultural Commissioner. It then popped up on my Facebook feed. You'll find it all over social media. The ag commissioners are the point of information at this point, but we'll be hearing more about this, I'm sure. This is a press release issued on May 26th by the Agricultural Commissioner Humberto Izquierdo, urging residents to take immediate precautions because invasive glassy wing sharpshooter was detected on grapevine plants sold at Sacramento area Costco stores, specifically including the Woodland, California store. This leafhopper spreads Pierce's disease, a bacterial infection that is fatal to grapevines and can also damage almond, citrus, and many ornamental plants, posing a significant threat, not just to California's agriculture, but also to home gardens. It does not pose a threat to humans or animals. Anyone who has purchased grapevine plants from Sacramento area Costco, and that includes us, we're in the Sacramento area, Costco stores beginning April 21, is asked to help prevent further spread of the pest by contacting the local county agricultural commissioner's office, Yolo County Ag Commissioner. Now that the glassy-winged sharpshooter has been confirmed on these plants, preventing further spread is critical, says the Ag Commissioner. We are working closely with Costco and our state and regional partners to identify the affected plants and protect local agriculture and home gardeners. So you can contact, if you purchased a grapevine from any Costco in the region, you're asked to contact the Ag Commissioner to schedule an inspection and pickup of affected plants. Do not attempt to return the plant or transport it or relocate it or dispose of it or even compost it. That might contribute to the spread of the glassy-winged sharpshooter. They would like to pick them up, and they will give you guidance on prevention measures. I'll give you the phone number if you're in Yolo County, 530-666-8140. Or this is really easy, agriculture@yolocounty.gov. So this
they got a good email address there.
Yes.
agriculture@yolocounty.gov. Perfect.
There you go. So this is a big concern because this particular pest attacks, as they mentioned, spreads Pierce's disease among grapevines, but attacks a lot of other plants as well. It infects the plant with a bacterium, and the plant basically dies. And it came into California in the 1980s. I was on the State Nursery Association Board of Directors from 1990 to 2002. So every meeting we had 2 to 4 meetings a year. Every meeting we had started with a glassy-winged sharpshooter update. The Ag Department came to us and said, you tell us how to stop the spread of this pest. Here's what exactly happened back then. This is a major threat to the wine grape industry. Wine grapes are, as the wine grape industry promptly informed the Department of Food and Agriculture, the number one cash value crop in California, at least the number one legal cash value crop in California. And they immediately convened a meeting with the state ag office and other affected industries, which to some degree included us, to put it mildly, walked in and demanded that the nursery industry be shut down in California.
Ooh.
Movement of nursery stock was to be prohibited into Napa County or any other wine grape or table grape growing county, and that was their demand. And the, you know the families involved in the wine industry in California, you'd recognize most of the names. And we were told about this meeting by our executive director. It was quite contentious. They brought in the citrus industry, the nursery industry, the wine grape industry, and the table grape folks and others in the farm, the farm labor, not farm labor, the agricultural organizations. Yes, Farm Bureau. That's what I was trying to think of. And they pounded the table and they said, we are the number one cash crop in the state of California and we need to shut this down because it's a threat to blah, 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 jobs and so forth. And our executive director waited very patiently for them to finish their rant, then raised her hand and said, I would just like to point out, we are the number two cash crop in the state of California, the nursery industry. So if you're proposing to shut down our industry to protect yours, I suggest you think about the ramifications to landscape contractors, home builders, all the economic ripple impact of shutting down the movement of nursery stock. So the ag department threw up their hands and said, you guys work it out. We had entomologists, we had nursery experts who got together, including the wine grape industry, and hammered out a method for quarantine that has worked for more than 20 plus years. Mid-1990s, a double quarantine system was put in place. At the point where the plants were shipped, they had to be inspected before they went out. If they were from a quarantine county, they had to be treated before they went out, if that was going to be appropriate in the ag commissioner's view. Then when they received, let's say I ordered from Southern California, the infestation was south of the Tehachapis in Southern California. I don't order much from Southern California growers, but some of the big places do in a big way, Home Depot, Walmart, places like that. So if something came up from an infested county, it had to be inspected before it went out, treated before it went out. It would arrive, let's say, at my nursery. We had to put it in a special holding area, call the ag commissioner in our county, who would immediately send someone down to inspect it before it could be released for sale. You can see there's some issues here with where exactly you're holding it and all that kind of thing. But I can tell you that on the rare occasions when we would get in something that required inspection, the ag commissioner had someone at our nursery in less than 30 minutes. They were down there inspecting right away. And it's not a hard insect to inspect for if you know what you're looking for. So they do a thorough but quick inspection, release it for sale, we'd take them into our nursery and sell them. That has kept the glassy-winged sharpshooter at bay for decades, a couple of decades now. When it was found occasionally, there was a nursery, division of a hardware chain in the Vacaville area where they found it, immediately shut it down, stop sales immediately, close the gates, treat, or establish a treatment or spraying protocol. There are organic options, it's conventional options, but you have to make sure it's something that's acceptable to the county and to the state. You inspect 3 or 4 days later, they release, they make sure there's nothing there, they open the gates up again. And they had to do this a couple times early on in the infestation. As long as you get cooperation from all the nurseries at both ends and from the different agencies that have sufficient funding to do this, it works. And it did work. We're not sure where this fell apart. This is the main reason we want people who grow nursery stock to be licensed, is that they now have a paper trail. They know everywhere they sold. They can go inspect not just the Costco's, but the other nurseries that this particular grower sells to. I posted the host list for Lois before we went on the air.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's everything.
There's everything. Are tomatoes on that, Don?
No, I'm happy to report. Tomatoes are not on the host list. Peppers are. Chili peppers are, but tomatoes are not. Please do your part if you happen to buy a grapevine at a Costco in Northern California sometime mid-April on. Let's talk about something more cheerful.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to be real cheerful here. Not only do tomatoes not get infested by this glassy-winged sharpshooter, but hey, Don has a first red tomato I've seen this season. He sent me a picture and there's 6 tomatoes and 2 of them are red.
What's the date today?
What's the date today? This is the 27th of May. And you took that
Isn't
picture this morning.
this morning, not quite ripe. I'd give that about 5 or 6 more days, but it's red. And so I've got to give you a little background here. I don't know if I've told you before, but on April 1, far too early in my opinion, by temperature conditions, soil temperatures, all that kind of thing, I planted 6 tomatoes. Six tomato plants, because they're already 2 feet tall in 1 gallon cans, and I had plenty more coming along. So I thought, you know what? I'm going to do what my customers are doing. I'm going to plant too early. So I went out there and planted. Now, if this is important, we had a couple metrics. We had gotten the soil temperature of 60 degrees, at least once, dropped back down because we were going into a cool spell, but it had gotten there. And we've been through that period in March when we had, what was it, 90 degree
Really
weather?
hot,
Nights
yeah.
in the 50s, it felt like late May, but then we were cooling back down rapidly. So I went ahead and I planted staked 6 1-gallon tomatoes, one of which has a ripe fruit forming on it. So this is the purpose of early planting. This is what all these guys are aiming for when they're planting way early, is to get that one ripe fruit, not quite by Memorial Day, but pretty darn close. And there's a couple things that if you want to do this, no, I do not recommend this necessarily, but first of all, use that first metric. The soil temperature is at least gotten to 60 degrees once. That's my first threshold. Second is by the calendar. March 1 would have been a little absurd probably, but April 1, not bad. We then went into a week of very cold weather, windy storm, very cold rain for about 7 days. All the plants turned yellow. They then turned kind of purplish. The new growth stopped completely. But this one plant had a cluster of blooms that had already set fruit on it. The plant sat, and so that's an important data point. The plant sat in the ground for 2 full weeks doing basically nothing, not dying, not growing, just sitting there. Finally, about April 2021, which is about when I would usually start planting, they began to green up a little bit and grow. So I began getting ready to plant my other tomatoes. Almost all the rest of my tomatoes went in May 1. So April 1, May 1. One of the ones that I planted April 1 had a cluster of fruit beginning to set. They expanded fine. We went through rough weather. Nothing affected the fruit. I was very concerned about that. And they're beginning to ripen. I think this is also really important. The variety is 4th of July. This one keeps coming up on lists for early production. Tougher skin, so it takes the weather better. Late season production for me has been good on 4th of July as well. It's a fairly small fruit. It's a 3 to 4 ounce fruit, like a small early girl. I wouldn't do a big fruited tomato real early and count on good results like this. A smaller fruited one is going to be better. I mean, you're kind of cheating when you do cherry tomatoes, but these are real actual, tomatoes that you could slice. So choose the right variety. Don't worry too much about what happens to the plant. Out of the 6, only one of them is doing this. None of them are growing as vigorously yet as the ones I put in a month later. So I didn't gain anything in terms of the vine's performance, the growth. They'll be fine. They're catching up. I can tell they'll all look about the same in 3 or 4 weeks. So as far as that goes, the early planting was not particularly harmful to the tomato plant. But if your real goal is that earliest fruit, choose the right variety, wait till the soil temperature has hit 60 degrees at least once, and you might do okay. The other 5, no fruit on them. They're growing okay, but as I say, they don't look any better or really any worse than the ones I planted later. I would note that there's a tomato I planted May 1, May 2nd, actually, according to my notes, which had a cluster of fruit on it, different variety, Thornburg's something or other, and they're ripening. So they're about a week behind the 4th of July. So the 4th of July is going to win the race this year, but the other one that I planted literally only 4 weeks ago is also setting some fruit, and it has set some fruit. It's expanded proper. It looks like it'll be ripening in 1 to 2 weeks. Experiment. Try different varieties. I'd aim for a smaller fruited one. Look for one that you know has good late season characters like Lemon Boy, Champion, 4th of July. Give those a try, and you might get that one fruit in the month of June that you can take a picture of and send to your friends back east.
So the next email that we got, it's been over a year since I last wrote to you. At that time, we had just moved to our new home in the pocket area of Sacramento and were battling cockroaches, with whom we have since decided to peacefully coexist, thanks to your advice. Now I'm writing.
You're gonna have to coexist with them anyway, so it might as well be peaceful. How's that?
Now I'm writing to ask for advice on shade tree choices for my front and backyards.
Tricky setup. I have a row of privet trees along the western fence that are most likely self-seeded volunteers from years ago. These are all over Davis. This is usually the Japanese privet, Ligustrum japonicum, because it's tree-like. It's not the Texas privet or any of the more compact hedge growers. It certainly looks like it from the picture. They're about 25 to 30 feet high and providing great shade in the summer. See the red circle in the picture. Without the privets, the area is mostly full sun, but I don't like privets as a tree and don't like having evergreens that block the sun in winter. So I want to replace them with a set of deciduous upright trees about the same height. An upright growth habit will be great for space saving. There are no utility lines and pipes above or underground in this area. So a couple of things about privet. First of all, almost all of my customers who have them nearby or have any kind of vegetable garden find that the roots of privets are aggressive and insanely annoying. People will build a raised planter and the privets are on the other side of the fence in the neighbor's yard, and a year later they're finding the roots coming up into the raised bed. So privets are very challenging. I don't know for sure that they're allelopathic. I don't know that they absolutely put a chemical in the soil, but I do know that not much grows under them. Could well be just competition, could just be that extraordinary network of roots. So they're not really fun to be around. The flowers smell, in my opinion, horrible, and many people are allergic to them. They're related to olives. And of course, the fruit is very popular with birds who disseminate it quite freely. So you often find lines of privets under power lines or under fence lines because of the birds going in there. And one goes on and describes a few found by Googling. Dana Spire columnar elm. Okay, it's a very upright elm tree. What do I think of it? Well, don't really know that variety that well, but yes, it drops its leaves in late November, early December. It's a very narrow, upright grower. It'll give reasonable shade coverage. Continues, I'm not set on the elm. Any other recommendations are welcome. I've considered Colrutaria paniculata fastigiata, Persian Spire parochia, a particular type of Japanese maple, and a columnar zelkova, and possibly crepe myrtles. Okay, 20 years ago, we all would have just said crepe myrtle. That would have been our first answer on this one. Yes, sir, 15 foot, 12 foot, 20 foot, which variety would you like? We've got 100 varieties available. We got one that'll fit almost anything.
And now they're all too drippy.
The aphids are a big problem. The crepe myrtle aphids showed up over 20 years ago, spread slowly but steadily throughout the region. And pretty much any crepe myrtle I look at now is infested with crepe myrtle aphid by June or July. The term you're looking for your Google search is fastigiate. And Lois did a search for this. And
I did, and it changed it to fastidious.
We love fastidious trees, yeah. But what we really want here is fastigiate trees. F-A-S-T-I-G-I-A-T-E. Fastigiate, which means upright.
So the Colrutaria paniculata has a variety called Fastigiata. That means upright, right?
Yes, and you'll find that name sometimes applied. Fastigiata is attached as a common name, or it basically means it's a columnar or perhaps slightly pyramidal or gumdrop-shaped tree. And this is a naturally occurring mutation in many species. Frank Schmidt Company up in Oregon, J. Frank Schmidt, S-C-H-M-I-D-T, has introduced many fastigiate forms of different deciduous shade trees, maples, oaks, things that have come along that happen to have this naturally, this very columnar, eventually slightly gumdrop-shaped growth habit. It's not uncommon and fairly stable, it appears, when it occurs. And so to them, these trees have great advantages for example, urban forestry. I mean, if let's say we're trying to plant G Street in downtown Davis, and we've got to replace the Bradford pears that are falling apart. Well, you want a tree with a relatively upright habit. That's why Bradford pear became so popular. All the Clariana pears had strongly upright growth habit, capital pear being the most upright. None of those are recommended at all, period, wherever you're listening. But the reason they were used is that fastigiate growth habit. So if we were going to replace those Bradford pears, we'd look for something fastigiate. Just addressing the ones you've mentioned, I wouldn't plant Colrutaria paniculata anywhere. No. It reseeds so prolifically that it is, in my opinion, invasive, an invasive woody species here and many, many other places that people might be listening. The parochia needs a lot of water. I don't think that's going to be a great choice if you ever get into drought irrigation restrictions. So it'll probably burn during heat spells. And same thing with the particular Japanese maple that's mentioned in the note here. So those two I would just rule out on the basis of a high likelihood of burning and not having good drought tolerance. If you want to water them, you know, parochia is a beautiful, interesting tree. But if you want to water it, you might consider that. But it wouldn't be my first choice here. And then mentioned columnar zelkova. Zelkova, also, there is a very fastigiate, two of them, very fastigiate forms that are out there. Of all the trees you've mentioned, that's the one you're likeliest to actually find at a nursery. So this is another issue. Going about this by Googling them and then going out and looking for the trees could be a rather frustrating experience. But that columnar zelkova is actually a very cool tree. It does get tall. It is a big tree, but this is one case where I believe with working with a tree service that you like, 3 to 5 years into the growth of your young tree, you could drop crotch it down to an existing lateral branch that's got a slightly upward growth habit, and you could just basically control the size from that point forward. It would mean someone who knows what they're doing, because I don't want you heading it, I don't want you hedging it, I don't want you stubbing it. I want them cutting to an existing branch that is chosen for its placement. Not that hard to do.
She said that the trees that they're considering taking out are 25 to 30 feet tall,
yeah,
and provide great shade. So yeah, I don't think we need to be too worried. Now, how tall does that columnar Zelkova get?
Oh, I suppose over 40 years, it could get 30, 40 feet, because Zelkovas are ultimately very big trees. Again, whoever's living in that house at that point may not care about that, but it's also one that could be managed and could be managed correctly. And there are other columnar trees. I have a fastigiate oak on my property called the Heritage Oak. I think it's actually a beautiful, fairly slow growing tree. It's an interspecific hybrid, and it grows a foot or two a year. So where I put it, it can get as big as it wants, but I can look at this tree and see how it'd be very easy to keep this as almost a formal accent in a garden because of the strongly upright growth of it. It literally is called Heritage. That's the name of the variety. It only grows a couple feet a year, so it would be an easy one to manage. And it's something that's out there. So you might take a look at that one. Heritage Oak doesn't drop its leaves till December, but it has the growth habit that you'd be looking for here. And it might well be, as we often suggest, a little diversity of species here. Choose a couple of strongly columnar deciduous plants so that you get sunlight through them in the winter, and then intersperse them with some evergreens, sort of like the privet, but much better chosen, Toyon or Xylosma or something, that'll give you some, you know, that you can keep at, say, 8 foot height, more or less as an informal hedge, that'll give you some privacy. So they would replace the function that the privets at least were being allowed to provide. You wouldn't mind so much if you're keeping them under 10 feet because they wouldn't shade the garden, but they would give some privacy. So consider a couple of fastidiate growers and many to choose from, and then perhaps some evergreens to go with them. I will point you towards my business website, redwoodbarn.com, and you'll find what grows here. There's a little link on the homepage, and it goes to a bunch of plant lists. And I have lists of trees that are very long and complicated. I have my 25 favorite trees. I have trees that are not recommended. Always fun to read those. And you might find some information there. So again, that word you're looking for is fastidiate, although sometimes growers use the terms pyramidal or columnar. And I think you're upright.
Upright.
What's that?
Upright.
Upright, yes. That would be nice if they would just say that. And there's a lot of trees in this category. A lot of them are evergreens. I mean, things like Italian cypress and whatnot. There's plenty of evergreens I can think of that would fit that spot. But the deciduous ones that are very fastidiate are kind of a cool subcategory of the shade tree industry.
So when you say upright trees, mm-hmm. the first things that pop into my mind are cherry trees. Mm-hmm. They're very upright. And aren't there trees that are cherries that don't have fruit?
Yes, there are flowering cherries that are very upright, and there's actually a couple flowering crab apples that are very upright. Now, I put these in the category of what I'm taking to calling garden trees. As long as you keep them watered correctly and give them the training they need and watch them for the various disease and pest problems that they get, you'll have a lifetime of enjoyment out of your flowering cherry or your flowering crab apple. But when I was on a large committee working on trees for shade trees, urban areas, residential plantings by the city, parks and green belts, we just completely removed them because these are just decorative trees that have a 25, 30, 40 year lifespan. Typically, that's most common, and they need some special attention, and they're not going to be happy if we get into serious drought restrictions, particularly the crab apples. But some of the flowering cherries can be longer lived. And the one in particular that I think meets Lois's description here is one called Kwanzan, Kwanzan. I would describe its habit as more fan-shaped, very upright, as opposed to a lot of the cherries that have a lovely, rounded, graceful weeping habit. This is more stiff and kind of formal, and it fits in landscapes where that's appropriate. If I'm looking at this backyard picture, for example, a Kwanzan cherry centered into the foreground with a couple of very fastidiate, let's say, hornbeams, Carpinus betulaeus. Behind it would be a very good combination, rather formal looking, but you'd get the different seasons of color out of each of these plants. And the cherry bloom on the Kwanzaa is the big fluffy pink double flowers and clusters, great profusion for about 2 to 3 weeks, very early in the spring. So something like a flowering cherry would work. You'll also encounter crab apples that have that same growth habit. I think you'd be happier with a flowering cherry than a crab apple, but there are flowering trees that would fit your criteria.
And I'm thinking of those paintings from France that have rows of trees and they're all really, really upright things. Mm-hmm. What are those? Lombardy something?
Lombardy poplars. Yes, those are a rural tree. I really like them.
They're too big.
Oh, yeah. Well, more than the point, the roots are very aggressive. So poplars, they're poplars, cottonwoods, and aspens are all in the same genus. So they all have the same problems. Now, if you're listening in a rural property, you should, I think cottonwoods are wonderful. Some of my favorite trees. And poplars have their place. There's long rows of Lombardy poplars along some of the farms out here in Solano County, planted many, many, many years ago. Some of them have been there for as long as I can remember. Sort of falling apart over the years because they typically, an individual tree will not have a super long lifespan, but they sucker very heavily. And so once you've planted Lombardy poplars or cottonwoods, you typically have them forever.
Okay. So there's a second part to this question, and this mm-hmm. is that front yard question. Yeah. This is about planting a small shade tree in the front yard. The area is mostly full sun. I want to shade the driveway from afternoon sun in summer, but don't want something too tall. Plus, I want some sun for planting other things in the front yard. And I want to also have the tree be deciduous, not too messy, and beautiful is a plus.
For this, there were some questions about specific trees, but I will go ahead and refer you over to my business website because there very specifically is a list there. Go to redwoodbarn.com, and on the What Grows Here link, you'll find another link to small to medium trees for gardens. And this is for Davis, which means it's appropriate to Sacramento. There are a few trees you could grow that I wouldn't be recommending because of slight differences in our water and climate, but not significantly. And so more likely, this will be a slightly conservative tree list for you if you want to look at it that way. And just go through some of those. Some are evergreen, some are deciduous. You might find some of them useful for your consideration. I see the flowering cherries are on here, for example. Flowering plums, yeah, all right, they would be fine there. But I'd be looking more at something like the Oklahoma redbud, which we've talked about as a variant of the eastern redbud that's tolerant of our hot, dry climate out here. Japanese maple would be a little stressed if it was in full sun, but the Shantung maple or Chinese maple, Acer truncatum, is proving very, very good for full sun areas as long as it gets adequate water. And there's another maple called the Trident maple, Acer bergerianum, B-U-E-R-G-E-R, bergerianum, or trident maple, referring to the shape of the leaf, shaped like a trident. That's proving to be fast growing. We think they're going to hit 40 feet, but they're easily shortened up effectively, safely to have a little more spread and reduce the height if you wanted to do that. So that's another maple that would work in that spot and could probably be allowed to grow big. I don't see anything in this picture that says it absolutely can't get more than 30 feet. So we're starting with the premise of a medium tree, but maybe they could be allowed to get a little bit bigger. You'll see some other familiar things on here like desert willow, a lot of evergreens, you know, olives and whatnot that you may or may not want to consider, but there are small trees that'll work. And so I'd suggest you head over and take a look at that list and maybe get some other ideas from that as well. You'll see crepe myrtles on there, you know, you'll see flowering cherries and crab apples on there as well. So be sure to check these against your irrigation intentions for that area and whatever else is going to be planted around it, that'll all be compatible in the landscaping. But there's a fair number. This has become a huge category for nurseries, is the small to medium trees. I wish there were more to choose from that are more long-term or that are native or that are more drought tolerant. There aren't that many, but people with solar panels, people that are in higher density neighborhoods are looking for smaller trees in general. We've got a lot of customers coming in from a new subdivision here in Davis where they're dealing with lot line restrictions. They're dealing with backyard that's only 30 feet deep total, and they don't want to, they can't plant anything that'll impinge on the neighbors. So they're looking for small trees. In many cases, we're actually steering them towards shrubs to be trained more like trees, because that may be more appropriate size-wise for what they're talking about. But as I say, head over to redwoodbarn.com and look for the small to medium trees list.
I'm looking at the picture. Thank you for sending the link, by the way, to the street shot of your house, because that makes it much easier to see than an overhead thing. I'm looking at your picture, and on the right-hand side of this picture, there's what looks like a purple plum or
Purpley plum,
something
yep.
like that.
Yep.
And that tree, because it's not a shrub, so it's not going to block the vision of everything. That tree looks like I think it would be a good there. You'd need to make sure you pruned it a little bit to keep it more upright and cut off any side shoots going over your lawn. But I think that one would be a really nice one. What do you think, Don?
It is. This looks like Crater Vesuvius, which is one of the classic purple leaf plums, and they're certainly popular. If you want something to augment that, you'll find some other, like we talked about before, flowering cherries and things of that sort that'll be about in the same size as that. Looking at this picture, the branch of that plum heading towards the house is practically horizontal. So someone needs to prune
That's the
that.
neighbor's. That's the neighbor's tree.
Yeah, I know. Someone needs to prune it pretty soon. Hopefully they'll do it right. I would say it could be taken off either entirely or at least to have the load reduced. If it doesn't get pruned, it will prune itself from the looks of this, especially if it
And
happens.
take out your fence at the same
Might
time.
do that. Yeah, hard to say. But yeah, it would work. And then there's a lot of other trees in that size range. And I see that this is a turf area, so it's probably going to be irrigated with turf, at least for the time being. We had some lively discussions about that as we were trying to come up with tree lists. Do we assume that it area that's in turf will always be in turf? Well,
I wouldn't.
they used
I
to assume
wouldn't.
that. In the 1940s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, it was figured, your front yard's going to be lawn. So the tree that goes in there should be able to tolerate lawn. Well, a lot of people took out lawns during the two major droughts we had between 2000 and 2010, essentially a 10-year drought with one wet year in the middle, and that was about it. People started taking out their lawns. We actually had statewide water restrictions, cutting back water 30%. A lot of trees suffered really badly because they had been expecting, counting on lawn irrigation. So I kind of hope everyone could now plan for the possibility of drought restrictions on our irrigation for trees. We would like you to give them special watering, but plan for the possibility that a tree you're planting in what is now lawn, 10 years from now, you may not have lawn there. It might well be that you'll have taken out the lawn and put in a much lower water landscape. Accommodate the tree with your irrigation system when you do that, please. I see so many problems with this, but also choose your trees. They should be able to meet up with the slide rule, as we call it, the ability to grow at 50% of measured ET for a season if they have to. My summary of the slide rule. Doesn't mean you're always watering them at 50% ET. It means if there's a statewide water restriction, you can water them less and they'll still be fine. And any of the things on my list there are likely to be okay with that, except Japanese maples, crab apples, some of the others, what we were calling garden trees in the earlier conversation. There is a further question at the bottom, though. For this front yard site, I'm considering Eastern Redbud. I've also considered Chinese pistache, Western Redbud, crepe myrtle. All right, so let's go through those quickly. Eastern Redbud are really popular right now. I'm getting people all the time asking about a bunch of these new varieties that have come on the market, all introduced by the gentleman down in the southeastern US who's been doing a lot of varietal selection on Cirsus canadensis. The only Cirsus canadensis that I'm willing to sell in my area is Cirsus canadensis texensis Oklahoma, the Oklahoma Redbud. It has a thick, waxy coated leaf that takes heat and even reasonable drought. Well, all the others burn here. My experience with them is they'll be going along fine in the spring. We'll have our first heat wave in late June, early July, and all the leaves on the west side, and oftentimes the whole plant will scorch, and then they'll look scorched for the rest of the summer and be very unsightly. So I would stay away from any Eastern Redbud in full sun in this climate unless it's Oklahoma variety. One caveat to that, Merlot, like the wine, Merlot, is apparently a burgundy foliaged version of Oklahoma. So we're told, and it's on the market. You can find it. So if it's like Oklahoma with that thicker leaf and a waxier leaf coating, it'll probably go through hot sun better than the other Eastern Redbuds. Not
But
absolutely
we don't
sure.
know yet.
We
We
don't know
don't
for sure. So you could be a beta tester for us. Yes. Chinese pistache is a very popular tree for a lot of good reasons. It is a big tree. 40 by 40 is a very common size for them after 20, 25 years. And they do spread out as much as they go up. So it's a lovely tree. And of course, they're very widely planted. That, in fact, has us a little concerned as to just how widely they're being planted. But to that end, if you're planting a Chinese pistache, be sure to get the male cultivar called Keith Davy. We don't want people planting female Chinese pistache because they do reseed and it has the potential to become an invasive species. The and male, of course, can't. Hmm?
And they're stinky.
Pistache?
Isn't that the one that has the fruit that's stinky? I'm thinking of ginkgos.
Yeah, I apologize. Well, same principle. Be sure to plant a male ginkgo too if you're planting a ginkgo. That's even more important. Yes. Now, the fruit of Chinese pistache is a lovely red little droop, and cedar waxwings certainly seem to like them. But we don't really want a lot of females out there because even if only a couple percent of them are sprouting, there's a lot of Chinese pistache out there, so we could get more seedlings coming up. Well, the male obviously can't do that. Also, Keith Davy was selected for fall color. So if you happen to go that direction, that's an option, the male cultivar, or there's a new hybrid, interspecific hybrid of pistache called Red Push. Tree Davis has been planting this. We're getting very good results with it. We've been planting them for several years, and we're seeing really good growth and almost, you know, no problems so far, basically. A nice fall color on it. It's an interspecific hybrid. It's naturally sterile, so you don't get fruit on them. And so that one is out there. And the name Red Push refers to the fact that the new growth flushes out red, kind of like a photinia does with a red color, and then it ages to green. So you have not just the beautiful fall color, but an interesting shot of color in the spring as well. And we like the idea of planting a different kind of pistache if you're going to go in that direction, because Pistachia chinensis has been so widely used, tens of thousands of them in the area. We'd like to see a little more genetic diversity in the city's tree programs. So we've been planting this interspecific hybrid just for the different genetics. That's part of it, just for to increase the species diversity in the urban forest. If your local nursery has Red Push, look at it. You'll have trouble telling it from a Keith Davy pistache side by side when they're young. The biggest difference is in the spring with that flush of new growth. The other question was about Western Redbud. I do get this a lot. If everybody's planting Oklahoma Redbud, how about the native Western Redbud? It should be grown as a shrub in this area for a variety of reasons. One is that it's slower growing. It's only going to grow, you know, very old Western Redbud 10 feet. More to the point, we get a branch dieback issue on it. That's happened to at least two of mine and happens to my customers as well. If you've got 3-4 shoots coming up, it's a multi-trunk plant. If you get this disease problem that hits, it looks like a Botrytis firea type of disease, if you're familiar with those. One branch will die, you cut it out, you throw that away, problem solved. Unless you only had it with a single trunk, in which case you've now cut down your tree. So we don't recommend Western Redbud as a tree. It doesn't get big enough. It does have this dieback problem. It's a great addition to a mixed border of shrubs for that very early, beautiful magenta pink spring bloom. And we've already talked about the issues with crepe myrtles.
Well, thank you for writing and let us know what you finally decide. Mm-hmm. I'll be interested to hear your thoughts on it too.
And as you go to nurseries, you may see some others, like some of the Eastern Redbuds. Jot down the names or take a picture and send them over and we can talk about them. There's trees that are for sale that I don't think are great choices for this situation. I mentioned the Eastern Redbuds. A great place for Eastern Redbud, for those of you living in William Land Park, the fabulous 40s in Sacramento, where you have a high canopy of London plane trees and pistache and ash and elms and such, giving light shade to the neighborhood. Those Eastern Redbuds, they've been planting them for years, not these new cultivars, but just the species itself. And they're quite beautiful. If you put them in full sun, they tend to burn. That's really actually a wonderful climate for a lot of understory trees. There's a lot of things that you can plant in those situations that we don't really recommend in more exposed settings. I'm going to throw one more out at you and then you can go do some more research. Vitex agnus castus, sometimes called chaste tree. Chaste, C-H-A-S-T-E. Vitex is a big shrubby plant that always has multiple trunks, so may or may not be appropriate in this setting. Yes, you could train it to a single trunk, I guess, if you want to. It's deciduous. It's got beautiful blue flowers, basically same size and scale as a crepe myrtle, anywhere from 10 to 15 feet, depending on the variety that you get. Very prunable bees, xylocopa bees, the carpenter bees love them, as do lots and lots of other insects. And so when they're in bloom, they're very active with wildlife, shall we say. And it's another possibility. Think of it more like a large shrub than a tree, but it's certainly one that you could factor into all these discussions.
You sent me a picture of a lily.
Yes.
Well, tell me about this lily.
I've been growing lilies, true lilies, Lilium genus, for years. They were one of the plants that I decided to methodically, systematically figure out how best to grow them. Do you stick them in the ground? Do you put them in the sun? Do you put them in the shade? Do they need special fertilizer? Do you have to dig them and store them? All that kind of stuff. I have mastered the art of growing lilies, and I can tell you all about it. If you're interested, I will start with the fact that they're very poisonous to cats. You always have to throw that in there because lilies are highly toxic to cats. Not out in your garden. I don't know exactly how a cat would climb up onto a 7-foot-tall oriental hybrid lily and get exposed to the pollen out in the garden. But if I were to cut it and bring it into the house and I had a cat, veterinarians will tell you this is probably one of the plants that really is the most dangerous. So be aware of that. Get through that. Lilies like to be in full sun. Their tops like to be in full sun, but my experience is the roots are best where they're lightly shaded. So it's like a clematis in that regard. As long as the roots have the moisture they need, lots of organic stuff on top of the soil, in the soil is fine if you want to do that. They'll do fine in the ground. As long as they can grow up into the sun, they will bloom best in full sun. My experience, since I have gophers on my property, is that I'm not going to take the risk of putting them in the ground because the gophers love lily bulbs. So I put them in big barrels. And I've even planted as many as 20 or 30 bulbs in a single barrel. One year I did that with tiger lilies. It made the most spectacular tiger lily bouquet you've ever seen. They didn't come back real well the next year. And I think that was partly because they were so close together. Probably one of them got a bulb rot and a whole bunch of them rotted out. So that wasn't optimal, but it sure was that summer. It was quite spectacular. A whole bag of tiger lilies in one barrel. Typically, however, I will plant 3 to 5 in a barrel. So we're talking about 3 to 4 cubic feet of soil for them because they are vigorous roots. And they also have contractile roots, which means over time they pull themselves down deeper into the soil. So you need a container that's deep enough. Just putting them in a 5-gallon container, a year later, you'll find that the bottom of the container, they simply won't have enough soil volume. They won't last very long. In a big barrel, they'll pull themselves down to the bottom. Just about the time the bottom of the barrel is rotting out, their roots will extend into the soil below. And I've had lilies in that situation come back for me for typically 3 to 4 years. Eventually, they rot out. They're a pretty soft, vulnerable bulb. They don't have a papery coating of any kind. They're never fully dormant like a daffodil or a tulip. They are soft and vulnerable to injury. So if you get them, you want to plant them right away. And if you do get a rot, you tend to lose the whole planting pretty quickly. But under the right conditions, a lily is a most amazing flower, particularly the ones called Oriental Hybrids or the Orient Pet Dwarfer series. The Oriental Hybrid lilies have flowers 7 inches across. The fragrance will make your eyes water. They're that kind of powerful, powerful, sweet fragrance. Picture I sent you was a tiger lily. If you don't want an overwhelming scent, it has a very pleasant, sweet scent. It's shorter, it's easier to grow. And my experience is tiger lilies come back for me better, multiply better than most of the other lilies. Most people plant a lily as a 1-year thing and they fizzle out and they're done. They think that's all you get. But you give them the right volume of soil, which is a pretty good volume. Lots of drainage and organic stuff either in it or at least on the surface, and plenty of moisture and the tops in full sun. Lilies are very, very much worth the effort to grow.
So, ending the show with the th same thing we started the show with, and that is that inch of rain that came down yesterday. So, is that going to change my watering pattern? Do I turn off the sprinkler? Do I leave the sprinkler coming on? What do I do?
I have a gentleman who comes by my nursery once a week through the spring. He's an older gent and he wants to know if he needs to water his lawn this week. Every Thursday, I chat with him. I expect I'll probably see him tomorrow. At some point, we get to the point where it's, yep, here on out, once a week, go ahead. This week, I intend to tell him he does not need to water his lawn.
And today I'll end with a quote from Barbara Damrisch. Good gardening is very simple, really. You just have to learn to think like a plant.
You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.